Well, welcome to our SilverLight 5 session. It's a pretty exciting conference this year. I mean, we've got a lot of breadth with the HTML5 stuff we've been talking about for your broad reach scenarios. And today we're going to talk about what we're doing with SilverLight 5 to kind of do your depth where productivity is really important for you. I'm Stephen Lasker. I work on the SilverLight team. I'm a lead program manager. And we're going to drill into a lot of things that we've been adding in SilverLight 5. Try to get a little bit more depth in what we've done at the Firestarter, for those of you that saw that. A lot of the focus that we did in this release was based on the feedback we've gotten from you. User Voice is a website that we use to solicit that feedback, where you guys can post feedback and then rate on it. And it's not very cleaned up, I guess. We don't really question what you post there. And we've got a lot of features that we're asking for, that you were asking for. And one of which I love was the data binding one, which I've highlighted here, which is, let me get rid of my data binding hacks. So how many of you have had problems with that? All right, so we are going to spend a lot of time on that today, because that's a couple of talks that we have today, today and tomorrow. So a lot of the focus around those data binding scenarios came around those that were doing MVVM patterns. And I'll do a little bit of talk here to put some context to it. But it turns out these features are more generically useful as well, but this gave a good theme to figure out why some of them were important. So I want to talk just really briefly about this, just to put some context to it. So many of you have been building applications for years, and the technologies are evolving, and there's lots of different sources of information you're connecting to. We've got lots of different data sources, everything from relational databases to telco switches, or, you know, different hardware you talk to, or media streams. They have services that return back that data in various different forms, and you have models that represent that data. All right? Now, the problem is that when you start coding to all those, we have all of this code that we have to aggregate all of these services. And not all the services were built at the same time and were necessarily built to work with each other. You might create orders for appointments, calculate tax, and you have to glue all of that together. And if you put that in the code behind, it becomes very difficult to try to do that in the next form or the next one. And now you have all this code that's gluing things together, and that becomes pretty complex to manage, especially when the technologies are evolving. How many of you rewrite your apps every time we ship a new technology? All right, the man over here. So it's pretty complex, and we don't expect that. And you certainly don't want your UI layers to have to think about all these different complexities and then have to figure out how to copy and paste that across each one of those forms. Many of you probably come onto a project that somebody else started, and it's pretty hard to figure out all of those. So we try to normalize that. The other problem is, how do you test all of this? Right? We have a lot of code that's there which isn't able to be reused in that code behind. How can you manage different updates to the UI? Right? How many of you get the UI first right the first time? Certainly, if there's developers, we probably have some designers in here who will say, no, you need us. And what happens when you want to put different UIs on that? Right? You might have different customers you might want to change the UI, or different form factors, such as, you know, the desktop and laptop, you might use the same one. But maybe you're doing a slate or a tablet, and you want to use more gesture input, or a phone where you just physically have a completely different screen real estate. So this has kind of evolved and been problematic. So not an uncommon thing, you guys would create class libraries to access all of that. And all MVVM does is formalize that as a way to aggregate all of that data, expose it as a set of properties, events, and methods, and to normalize it so now we can connect to it with the UI and make it very easy to not deal with all the underlings of happening down below. I could then write test APIs to, you know, test all that functionality, because that's the meat and bones where it's a lot of the instability happens. And I could very easily start to put other UIs on that and know that my functionality is nice and stable. The problem is, how do you do all of this unless we, you know, how do you reduce all that code out of the UI? If that's the goal, well, the answer that we, you know, that many people are using is data binding. So that was where a lot of these problems came from was I were, you know, abstracting all these things out, and I didn't have access to it because my code is sitting up here. It doesn't know about what's going on below, and data binding did not necessarily pass a lot of that information up. So some of the features that we've added in Silverlight 5 and are listed here, these are what I'm going to show today. And we're going to walk through each one of them in some amount of depth, depending on, you know, the complexity of each. Not all of them are in the beta that we announced today, and I'll highlight those as we go through. So the first one is binding and style setters. So John showed this very quickly this morning. Let's take a look at some more examples of this. So we've built an application here that we call Silverlight Insurance. And in this app, we have the ability to look at a list of appointments that we're going to go visit. And for each appointment, we can then go and put details for the claim that we have to file, right? Damages to vehicles, and I can go back and do more damages. And I even have some rich data binding with visual elements on here, which we'll use in a little bit. So on this list, though, I might want to customize this for the different branches. We kind of made this fictitious company for Silverlight Insurance, and they're a national company, but they have branches around different, you know, down the country. IT lives in corporate. The local branches don't have any IT people, but they might want to customize this a bit. So if I'm the administrator of the app, I could come over to settings, and I can now change the color themes of my app. And as we noted before, I'm not much of a designer. Let me get some color in there so you could see. And using binding and style setters, by setting it in one place to this object that all my styles are bound to, when I go back to appointments, I'm consistently using this very ugly pattern across my whole app. Now, this is the beauty of data binding, because I can come over here and just say, you know, this is not working for me. I'm just going to reset that back from a value that I store in the database, so that I can now get it back to normal. I was able to experiment with that. Let's take a look at how this works. So in Visual Studio, we've got a set of assets here, just like you would do normally, with something like branch styles. So this is just a set of styles that you could have set up with Blend. And then what I've done is I've gone to the property of background, and I've changed the source to actually use this branch style object that I've instanced. It's here in my resources, and I simply bind to this property on this. It's that simple. No other code in my app has to do anything for all my style setting. I just have this one type. So I come over here to models, and we'll go to the branch style, and all I have is a set of properties that implement iNotify property change. So any place then that color picker where I set the property, it raises an event, and all of those styles that are instance at that point will listen to that event and change the color, the font, the style, whatever it is that you have on there. And then I just have some code in here in my click event that I, well, not the click event, but in the method that gets called to go back and reset those values from the database. So it's that simple. Pretty productive? All right. That's what we're talking about with Silverlight here. It's my clicker. So just to recap, we take a class, we implement iNotify property change so that we can bubble that up to the UI. We take our style and we simply change it to use, we instance the style rather, and then in the style setters, we go and we just pull it off that object. Very, very simple. Implicit data templates. So this one's kind of interesting too. So let's take a look at our app. And I've got this state combo box that is bound to a state object. And the state has the code, you know, NY, LV, whatever, and then the name, the longer name. And in the dropdown, I want to show both, but in the collapsed, I only want to show one. There's two parts to this. So normally, I can just come over here to Blend, and I'll select the state combo box. And I could come over here and apply a template, edit templates, additional templates, apply resource, and I have a state data template that I've already set up for this. And using design time data, I can immediately see exactly that, you know, this is working. So cool. I'll save that. I'll come over here, and I'm just going to rebuild to get that style into my project. build process, build succeeded, and then I'll just refresh my page, and now I've got my state codes displayed in here. So now I'm using my data template. The problem is that here I've named it. If I go over to appointments, we'll notice that I don't have it here. So I didn't actually think to go back all the places in my application and find where that data template is used or should be used and apply it. So what I can do with implicit data templates is I open up my data templates file that I have here, and instead of using a name, I can change this to say data type equals data models state. So now any place that a list box is using that state object, it'll now apply this template. So let me just save this, and we'll get rid of that. Let me go over here to blend, and I just need to remove that name state data template. We'll get rid of that, save, we'll rebuild, and now what'll happen is every place that object is used, I'll now be able to automatically apply it. I don't have to worry about naming it in all my different projects and all my files, and bang, don't worry about that. We'll go to appointments, and let's go to settings first, this one, and it's still applied here, but now without even opening this other form, my state was already applied to that as well. So another one of these really powerful productivity features that we have by leveraging Silverlight Managed Code and Blend and Visual Studio. All right, let's come back here. So again, real simple. We moved from a data template, a named one, and we were able to just pull that code out and now use a specific data type. But what's really cool about this is it actually goes further. Let's say, and John talked about this a little bit this morning, but let's say I've got a collection of vehicles. And the vehicles, I have a base type, it's vehicle, but then I have derived types for car, truck, and motorcycle. And let's say I want to format those slightly differently. And the image is overly simple. So let's go back and look at my app here. And on the vehicles tab, I could customize this layout that on cars, it's really important to know maybe the color and the number of vehicles. But on a truck, I don't care what color it is. I want to know what the maximum gross weight, what the height, length, what it can haul for me. And for a motorcycle, there's not much to it, so I can just free up that space. All right? So very easily, I can apply these implicit data templates and use heterogeneous collections to format all of my list boxes and just do it in one central place, and any place that's used in the app, it just picks it up. Cool? All right, relative ancestor binding. So here is a place where we can actually start taking advantage of things that are, you know, our ancestors. Somebody that has teens, I kind of defer back to my father and say, how are you doing this for me? Where my son, he's not looking up so much. But in code, it works a little bit better. I've got to try to apply that at home. We'll see how that works. So let's say I've got a list box that's got a collection of appointments. All right. Now, in that collection of appointments, I want to be able to edit those, and I've got a status that I can apply to each one. Now, the problem is when you start pulling out all that code behind code, and you just want to set up data binding, I don't know when this data template is going to be applied. So I don't really have visibility into where I'm going up in the call stack. So what I can do is I can take ancestor binding, and when I instance my view model on my view, I've set the data context to it, so that now in code, I can set up my data binding for that combo box for status to go look up the visual tree. In this case, I've said look for a user control, the host panel, because that's where my view model is set up. So I look up the find ancestor and then bind the data context.status to its item source. All right? So without this, it was pretty complex to be able to set up those combo boxes for that. Now with relative ancestor binding, it's pretty straightforward. But there's another place I can use this as well. If we noticed in my demo here, I was mentioning that my state combo box, when it's expanded, I want to see the name and the code. But when it's collapsed, I don't want to see the stuff bleeding through. So what I can do is I'll come over to my data template again. And this time, what I'm going to do is I'm going to use the state name text block that I have and set up the visibility is going to be set up on a binding to the is drop down open. And what I'll, get over here. And then I want to say it's a relative source. And I'm going to set the ancestor type equals to a combo box, all right? So I'm going to look up for the combo box in this data template, and I'm going to bind the is dropdown open. And the only last thing I need to do is set up a converter because of the visibility as a tri-state. So I'll say, and I have a static bool to visibility converter. All right, that should be it. Let's just build this and make sure. Life is good. Poof, great. So now I'll refresh my page, and voila, when I'm expanded, I get both. When I'm collapsed, it goes away. And because of implicit data templates, I come over here, and it's taken care of in here as well. All right, so another thing, just kind of building on each other and all the productivity I can get here. So quick recap, again, we just set up that hierarchy on that where I'm just looking up my control stack and here I'm just binding to the is dropdown open on it. So this one's another powerful one. So John showed this also this morning. And usually by this point, I've probably already used this feature. So I'll drill in a little bit more. Now, one of the other problems that I noticed is here, I'm missing my state combo box. My zip code. So I'm going to come over, and let's first run this in debug mode, actually. So we'll hit F5 on our app. And now when I go to settings, we'll see that it's still blank. So I could come over here to Visual Studio, and I'll go to my branch view. We're done with data templates. And in our branch view, I'm just going to set a text, set a breakpoint here in my text. So what's nice is now in XAML, I can set breakpoints and actually look at the data binding engine that's going on at that point. So it works on data binding. So we're really going to call it data binding debugging. And now, when I go and refresh this page, and I come back over here, that XAML's parsed again, and it's going to pick this up and go, well, wait a second, what do you want to do here? And if I look at my locals window, in my locals, I can see that I have an exception because they couldn't find the property zip code or zip on that. So I'll come down and look at my final source. And if I look here, I do not see that on there, but I do see a selected branch. And it turns out that I forgot to put the selected branch object there in the root. So just come over here, and I'm actually going to use blend here. And I'll come over, and I'll just go to the text property, text, data binding, selected branch office. And now I'll go grab the zip. And boom, I'm done. Save it. And yep, reload. Saved it right there. So now when I do a rebuild, it'll now pick up all those changes, and now I can test to see how this works the second time. All right, we're good. Settings. Breakpoints hit. I can see states like updating target. I can go down and look at the final source. And in this case, the data binding, the data load hasn't happened yet because it's all async. Hit F5 again, and it runs through. And because the property change notifications fired up, my selected branch got loaded, binding kicked in again, and now I could see where my properties all are. So lots of visibility inside of data binding debugging, takes a lot of that mystery out, and really get you productive again with your apps. Thank you. All right, let's take a look here. So just quick recap on this one, too. I set my breakpoints, and then inside of that locals window is where all of the information, and that's the magic. A lot of people will fire up data binding debugging, and where do I look? Right? Because we're not really trying to read through all the XAML code. We're really trying to figure out what the data binding engine is doing. So we surface up this binding state object, and then the locals window, you can look at all that information. But what's really cool is once you hook up to the data binding engine, to the debugging engine, we could take advantage of all of the other features of it, such as the condition. Because sometimes your errors might only happen in certain opportunities. There might be certain objects that are loading while others aren't. So I can set up a condition that only fire and stop on that if there's actually an error in that binding. So another place you could hook into it. Custom markup extensions. So here's another one, and I'll use some of our colors from our MVVM pattern that we talked about earlier to put some context to this. So a lot, we've talked about how the code behind is a place where you can't really do a lot of testing on your code. It's not to the point of you shouldn't have any code behind. I like Laurent's comment on that, is this is not a religious battle of we need to get rid of all code and the code behind. It's just that code should be unique to the UI, and you're probably not going to have a good chance to be able to test that with a lot of great tools. What we want to do is move them down to the API. So here in this case, I'm just doing some, on the selected index change, I'm going to go get some data for the claims. Now I do some data loading, and I'm using RIA services here, so I get the nice async pattern. So on the callback, I might load the elements directly into the list box. Not using data binding here. So go off and do all that data access. But let's see how we could clean this up. So I'm going to come over here to Visual Studio, and we'll get rid of these breakpoints, and we'll stop this. And in my home view, I've got some custom markup extensions that I've set up here, and right now I'm using the selected index changed. And if I go and just go to that point here, I'll set a breakpoint in the view, okay? And we'll go through, and in the view model, I've abstracted this out. I didn't worry about putting all the data loading code in the UI. The point here is to focus on the custom markup extension example. So now if I hit 5 on this one, we'll see as we expect, right? On the selected index changed in the view, that's firing, and that's got to imagine all that code that we're trying to get out of the view. And then I'm stepping into the view model. So let's get rid of all that. What I'm going to do is come back over here, and instead of this method that I've got, the click event handler I've got in my view, I want to set this up to actually go into the data context, get the view model, and call a specific method. So what I can do is I'm going to use a helper that I wrote, and I want to get the IntelliSense, so give me a second here. Kick that in. Selected index change, selection changed, helpers, method invoke, and notice I'm getting some IntelliSense here on my custom markup extension. So I'm just going to tab out of that, and now I can set the method name that I want to be called on my view model. So we'll come back over here. I'll just go and grab that, paste it in there, and now that's all going to wire up. But how does that work? So we didn't actually ship method binding. The feature we're shipping here is the ability to write custom markup extensions. I just happen to write one that uses method binding here. So I'll come over to my helpers library, and here in my method invoke extension, I've written this sample here. So notice I've got a property that was that IntelliSense that came up that said method. And the method invoke that I named is the name of the type that derives or implements iMarkup extension. And similar to attributes, we have a naming convention that I just add the extension to it, and that's how we pick them up. So I'll set a breakpoint here, and we'll walk through this. Put F5. So now, instead of calling that click event in my code behind, it will actually parse that XAML, which is what's happening here, provide value as that internal method that gets called. And then as I set this up, I've got a couple of services that I hook up. I get the target provider, and if I look closely at it, I can see that it's my list box, and the selection changed event I was able to grab off of that through these services. I then go through some code to figure out how I want to set up my event handler, and we'll just skip through all of this here. We create a delegate to wire up the event handler on our target method, on appointment changed, on the target adjustment adjuster dashboard view model. Right? So in this code, I've got a pattern that I'm assuming, and I can go pull off information out of the object model that's available to me. And then when that's all set up, this generic handler will be wired up, so the XAML's parsed. I'll hit F5 here. Yeah, sorry, didn't talk fast enough here. Let me redo that again. Just got a timeout. So I'll reset that. So again, parsing the XAML, do that once. And now the selection changed fired for the initial loading, and I'm now in that event handler. And notice it went straight into my view model. All right? So very easily I was able to just write an extension and use it all in my code. And now as I move, points here, only my event handler is firing. All that parsing doesn't have to run again because my UI is already loaded. Right? So another example here. So how that works, we implement iMarkup extension. We use the naming convention. I expose the properties that I want to be available to me in IntelliSense. I implement provide value, which is the infrastructure that we use, that we will call that when the XAML is parsed, and you can set up whatever you want. You might want to apply validation routines, standard validation routines. You might want to do some adorners that are special to your controls. There's all kinds of possibilities of what you can do with markup extensions. And then you just instance them, you know, back in your XAML. Cool? Okay. So here, just to kind of put some round trip to that, is notice in this example, I was able to, again, eliminate this code from my code behind, and now I could put it down in the view model and doing all my testing and just let my UI be skinned, bind to properties, events, and methods, and I could use some custom extensions as well. So data context change is another one. It's an interesting one because in this case, we've debated, like, well, you changed the data context. Why do we need a raise event? You just changed it in your code. Why can't you go deal with whatever you've done, you know, with why you need it changed? Well, again, when you're looking at MVVM patterns where you've got these higher level objects sitting on top that don't have any visibility into what's going on below, you're assuming some things happening with eventing. And it turns out that people wanted to be able to hook the data context changed so that when they've wired up controls for validation, again, using adorners, where you're looking for the iNotify property change, that if you change the data context, you wind up with these framework element leaks because you're still hooked to that old object. So with data context change, we can now expose that, and you can use the old value to unhook the events and then use the new value to hook the events for the new object that's got set. So great opportunity to be able to do this. This, again, is one of the features that is not in the beta that you've gotten today. This is coming soon, but it's pretty straightforward. Update source trigger. Here's another one. Small feature, adds a lot of functionality for you. So let's say that I want to parse VINs, vehicle identification numbers. Now with VINs, they're actually fairly complex. There's a lot of rich data in it. There is a year, make, and model. And what you would imagine is for a year, I can get a list of makes, right? Honda, Acura, BMW, whatever. And then for that model, make, I can get the model, you know, MDX, TL4, whatever. Problem is that the VIN is not in that order. It actually is model, then some stuff around the engine size, and then some other information, and then the year, and then some serial numbers and other things. So if you want to type into a text box the VIN, and you want to get some feedback around, am I typing in the right information for this model, I want to be able to get some immediate feedback. And if you wanted to be able to do that today, you would actually have to handle the text changed event. Because what we have done is optimized our data bind to not be very chatty, and in text box, only pushes the value to the data binding engine after you've lost focus of the control. So you have to hook this text changed event, again, in your code behind, and then you would do all of this code. So let's just take a look at how we could do something here. So let's just clear all our breakpoints here. And stop debugging. And we'll go to our incident view. Update. So on my update source trigger, right now I'm not doing anything. So I'm just going to hook the text changed event. And we'll see why this could be good, but maybe not so much. So I'm going to run this again. And this time, I've already got that set up. So I've already got the code in there for text changed. And I already wrote this routine for parsing vehicles. So go to appointment. And I'm going to type in 0. I already got an error. So what's happening is this VIN parser that we set up is trying to go in and get the year, make, and model. But because the first code is actually the make, I didn't actually finish typing the second digit yet. I got back a nullable year, and then I can't apply that to our autocomplete text box. Now, this is a really complex piece of code to actually run back and forth, and it's something that we spent several hours actually debugging, and we've got that set up now in our view model, so that's what I want to leverage. I don't want to have to put this code here and copy and paste that. All right, so let's pull out of here. So now what I'm going to do is instead of using the text changed event, I'm going to go into the data binding and simply say update source trigger equals property changed. So I'm going to change the default, and now in each keystroke, it's going to push it into the bound property that I'm on that, and in that code, I've handled all of the parsing of the VIN properly, and it'll just work. So let's save that. We'll come back over here, and we'll just relaunch that. We'll open a claim, and now as I start typing, what did I do? Okay, hold on. Oh, I didn't refresh this, sorry. And that's the other one, no problem. Okay, so now, all right, hold on. I don't think I built, I think that was the problem here. So just get the change in there, so it'll actually work. It'll use the code that I wanted to use, and it'll be good. All right, ready. Let's try that again. We'll go to our appointments. We'll come over here. And now as I type in, as soon as I typed in enough for the code, I was able to get the model out. And if I go through and it's the seventh or eighth digit, I always forget, I can get the year. And now, as I start scrolling through, I can get my year, make, and model out of there. So some code that I was able to test and make sure, and now I just hook it up to the UI, and it's pretty straightforward. All right. See how we're doing here. So again, update source trigger is another feature that we didn't quite get done for the beta, but it's coming, right after that. And here I was able to just get rid of, again, all of that code in the UI and leverage that code down that actually parses VINs and sets the properties on my objects. And that's where I've handled all of those dealings with the nullable types, figuring out the model. And after I have the model, I have the year, go get the make, and you know, all of that kind of stuff. All right, so WCF RIA services. Here's another one where the team has been focused really hard on providing a lot of great end-to-end value. So we're, one of the things we're announcing today is SP2 for RIA services, and this will be available for you today. And in RIA services for Silverlight 5, some of the work that the team has done is they've added the ability to support complex types. So let's say you have a customer, and it's got an address, and the address is actually this formalized object. So I can get address line 1, 2, 3, so forth. You will now have support of that right in the RIA services. So how many of you would ever use the type data set or type data set generator back in earlier days? All right. So one of the big features we always heard was I wanted to customize the code gen. I don't really like the code you've done, or I want to add some enhancements, and I just couldn't get in there. So one of the things that they've done is they've implemented T4 templates, so now you can control the output. You can change the base class that it's derived from, add some new functionality, insert your own default validation. Whatever it is that you're trying to hook into there, you can now completely control that. We've got support for date time offset. So for when you're, who knows where your data center is in some part of the world, and you have users connected from different locations, you can now leverage the SQL data type date time offset to adjust for those. We now have better MVVM support. This is one of the challenges that people were saying they had with RIA services. So we've taken that feedback and incorporated that in. And we've got the entity framework code first generation coming as well. So a lot of great feedback coming in and incorporating and making RIA services better for you guys. But wait, there's more. So I wasn't sure about using this guy, but I just decided I had to go with it. So we've done other work. So I've talked a lot about the features we've added in data binding and helping your MVVM patterns. And you know, a lot of this is that productivity level for your business apps. But we're also reaching out for other areas as well in the text and printing. And these are pretty typical in your business scenarios as well. So let's take a look at some of them. So with text, we have linked text containers. So I have text that might want to flow around some content. In this example, I have some help content that helps the user figure out how to manage that claim for the car, right? And I can make this pretty robust, but I want to flow that text around that like you would do in Word. So by setting this up with different rich text boxes, I can tell it where the overflow should go so that it'll flow around that. So let's take a look at this. So in our app, we've set this help up. Again, I mentioned that we've got the ability to have not only images, but we've also put some media in here as well. And as I resize this, the text will flow through those boxes, you know, automatically for you. All you have to do is just set up where the overflow should go. I could change the font size, and again, very rich formatting that I can put right through there. Pretty cool? All right, text clarity. Scott mentioned this again this morning. It turns out that on low-res devices, it still becomes hard to see, and it's not just because I'm old and need more glasses. It's just, you know, we've really increased the density of information in a small amount of area, and when you blow it up to see it, because it's hard to see in, you know, on a big screen, if you look closely, you'll see how blurry it is. And to make it a little more obvious, if you look up at Asian characters, which have so much information in a dense format, you can really start to see the difference. So by changing the default on this, we can now snap to pixels. And if you look at the top one compared to the bottom one is slightly larger because we moved the text to align to the pixels on those low density monitors. So this is also coming post-beta, but just give you an example of some additional work that we're doing. Printing. How many of you guys were doing printing work? All right, we added the feature in Silverlight 4. It was based on bitmap printing, and we immediately started getting feedback going, holy cow, these files are big, and this has taken a while. So we've implemented vector printing in Silverlight 5, and we can see some pretty dramatic performance here on, you know, text, on the spool time, and as well as when we send the files to the printer. And this is just a representative sample. You know, the percentages there get pretty extreme. But it's also, we have much better clarity, too. If you look at the bitmap, you can see you get those jagged edges compared to in vector, we can actually plot that out on the PostScript printers and actually get really crisp resolution. So the last one that I want to talk about is trick play. So trick play, Scott mentioned this morning, you might want to get through your videos a little quicker, or you might want to search for something. So how many saw Laurent's presentation yesterday? All right, so he was talking about how he speaks kind of quickly, and you could always watch the video later. But do you really want to keep on going back and replaying it again? Wouldn't it be nice to be able to play that at different speeds and still hear them? Now, what's nice, as Scott talked about, is when you fast forward something, normally you'd get this chipmunk sound. We can actually do pitch correction and solve that. So I'll come back here to my video, and if I play this, I can start to hear what's going on.
This video demonstrates how to make proper photos of the damaged vehicle after the car accident.
Yeah.
So that the photos can be filed for the insurance claim and repair.
So I can fast forward.
There's a car accident! Now I'm about to take my camera.
And now I've got this pitch correction.
And now I'm going to make photos.
Okay. You still understand what he's saying.
Get the phone. Check the back. Check the tires.
You wish you could do this with your car?
Check the inside.
So I'll slow it down for normal play.
Check the lights.
But I might want to slow it down and really pay attention to what he's saying.
And that is...
Okay, so with pitch correction and trick play, we can now fast forward through your videos. And, you know, while his voice is a little bit young, but you can hear that it doesn't change in pitch as I went to fast forward or slow. So now you can watch Laurent's presentations and not have to keep on pressing pause and rewind. So, just kind of wrapping things up here, we've done a lot of work in Silverlight to really focus on the productivity. We've done a lot in the data binding engine. We've done a lot for even the code that you've already written to improve your productivity with debugging. We've done a lot to improve our better with text and in printing to improve performance and improve your capabilities. We've brought forward the media players with next-gen capabilities. Silverlight 5 ships the second half of this year. We've got a lot of features that we've got here. This is by no means all of them. We have some additional talks this afternoon and tomorrow. I look forward to your feedback. And with that, I just want to say thank you, and I really appreciate you guys coming. And we're looking forward to the new year. Thank you. Sorry. Yeah, go ahead.
To be side by side compatibility, I can have Silverlight 4 and Silverlight 5 beta in side by side.
So you have an app that was built against Silverlight 4 and another one that's built against Silverlight 5.
Is that more for development? Sorry for my English. More for developing the properties. I have an application.
So you want to stay in Silverlight 4?
Yes, but I would like to experiment Silverlight 5. Can I have both side by side? Is there a studio function with both?
So the way that we've done this is both for development and runtime. So in the development environment, you can target whether you want to compile and run against Silverlight 4 or Silverlight 5. There's a property in your property page, and it's the same thing for 3 and 2. So what's nice about that is you can then target depending on what the rest of your app is doing. At runtime, we actually will know what app or what version you were compiled against, and we'll keep that capability. So the traditional scenario here is that I've got this, all these apps that are out there on a particular version of a browser or a particular version of Silverlight, and then I move forward, and because the next app is taking advantage of Silverlight 5, let's say, and I don't want to risk breaks to my Silverlight 4 app. Because the last thing I don't want is to not let somebody roll out my new version of the app. So what we've done is we have a feature we call Quirks Mode, and in the code, we actually detect what version of Silverlight you're running against, and we will give that same behavior. So we have bugs, you know, but when we fix those, let's say we fix some bugs in Silverlight 5, if it changed the behavior, your code might have depended on that behavior. So that code that was in that Silverlight 4 app will continue to use that behavior, and your app that was compiled against Silverlight 5 will use the new behavior, and you'll get that. So you no longer have to worry around deploying 5 versions of apps and worry about your 4 breaking. And in Visual Studio, if you're not ready to bump up to the new version for whatever reason, you can target it. So you don't need to actually have side by side. We keep the behaviors, you know, with the versions of the Silverlight.
Thank you.
Okay.
You mentioned some new tooling, I guess, around MVVM and Rhea. Can you kind of talk about that any?
Well, I didn't really mention tooling per se.
Okay,
I was more focused on the runtime enhancements that we've done.
Yeah.
So, you know, as we've gotten more feedback around people using MVVM patterns, they were hitting a lot of these, you know, speed bumps that we had to just do some work in fixing. So that was a lot of the stuff I spent some time on today, okay. Was talking about that with data binding and
okay.
You know, those kind of features.
But that's what you're referring to, the data binding?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, there was a bullet on the last slide I didn't see content for. That was the binding to custom objects.
Yeah, so despite me talking quickly through that, my normal timing was had me full. So we've implemented a feature that's actually in the beta as well. And the scenario that we've targeted around is the ISVs, or, you know, ISV is the main scenario that we target around, is post-deployment. You've already got your app. It's compiled. It's deployed out at customer sites. And for something like an accounting package, where you might want to enhance the product item, and say that my product has another property on it, but you still want to take advantage of data binding. So now we have something we call iCustom Type Provider, which that's implemented is at runtime, you can go and add properties to your objects, and the data binding will pick up on that.
Type descriptor like full framework would do? Okay.
So one of the changes is the CLR changed the model. They're moving to more of a reflection-based model, and they didn't want to use type descriptor going forward. So Silverlight just happens to be shipping this behavior first, but you'll see this in the full version of the framework eventually as well.
So it's iCustom Type Provider instead of iCustom Type Descriptor,
correct.
Et cetera. Okay.
And you'll see that in the beta. We'll have a helper class, because implementing type is a lot of code. So we have a helper sample that we're going to make available. And it's just it's a complex demo to walk through, and I just didn't have the time to walk through.
Sure. So most of these features have been in WPF for a while. Do you know, or have you tracked, what is the markup compatibility percent between WPF and Silverlight now as a result of these pieces here?
Yeah, it's hard to take a percentage. I mean, you know, we've really been careful around what functionality to bring into Silverlight, because we really wanted to make it, you know, a lightweight, fast, you know, performant engine that was easy to deploy. So if we pulled in everything, you know, we'd wind up in the same boat. I guess we're really looking at a lot of scenarios that people got blocked on, because you're right, some of these features that I showed today are things that already existed in WPF and we're just bringing forward. So that's why we look at things like user voice and, you know, customer feedback that we talk to figure out what are the right set of things we bring forward.
So in Silverlight 4, binary compatibility was brought up, but I haven't heard it mentioned at all about Silverlight 5. Was there additional work done in that space to improve binary compatibility between the two zones?
What do you mean by binary compatibility? No, we were looking, you know, we're looking at how you can reuse your XAML and reuse your skills, but, you know, we're not trying to take a binary. Now, but I will say the other way is true, although we hit an interesting problem just recently with this, is you could take a Silverlight app that was compiled against Silverlight and run that on your desktop, because you can take that subset for things like validation. I did did that in the example here, is I have some separate validation classes. So that works as you can take the Silverlight one and run it on the superset. Mm-hmm. We ran into a little interesting issue, is that it looks like the loader was based on the version, and the fact that Silverlight 5 is a higher version than the CLR, it didn't know how to find another version. So I have to look into that more. One of the nice things is, and John was using it in his demo, is portable class libraries is a new feature, and that's more really targeted at that, is how do you have a common set of DLLs that you can share across phone, device, desktop frameworks. So I'll direct you to both of those as examples.
Great, thanks. Hi.
Hi, how you doing?
Good, how are you? Does it come with a Go Live license, the beta?
Yeah, so we weren't able to do the go-live on this beta. So today, you know, we're announcing for you guys to do development against it, continue to give us feedback, and we'll finish up, and we'll have the go-live with the final release.
Okay. And a question about RIA services. Mm-hmm. There was a limitation where you couldn't have many-to-many relationships or something like that in the... It's still a limitation.
So it's still a limitation. I have Depesh is here, and he's our RIA services guy.
As soon as that's fixed, I'll start using
it. So keep the feedback coming. I guess we still have some work to do.
Right, great, thanks.
Currently with Silverlight 4, there's a limitation in the printing with you can't print larger than legal size. Is that going to be fixed with the vector-based printing, that you'll be able to print some large plots?
I wasn't aware of that as a limitation, but I have to follow up more with you. So I'm looking at Sam. So we can follow up offline. I'm not aware of that as a limitation.
Okay, thank you. And then also with data triggers between Silverlight and WPF, in Silverlight, they're very difficult to work with, and you can't even get data triggers in the out-of-the-box Silverlight. You have to do it through Blend or with the Blend SDK. Is there any future with making that a little bit more streamlined?
It's something we've been looking at, is triggers and behaviors, and trying to consolidate those. At this point, we don't have anything to talk about. You know, we know that that's an ask, and it's something we'd like to be able to do.
Okay, cool. Thanks.
How you doing? You showed us an example of implicit data templates using the type of an object. Can you also use the state of an object to make those decisions?
What do you mean by the state?
Like, let's say on your car type, you had some property that indicated if it was like a sedan or an SUV or something. You could use the value of that property to make
decisions. Oh, like a body type kind of thing?
Yeah, I've got a template to show an SUV, I've got a template to show a sedan, that sort of thing. I think you can do that in WPF.
I have to think about that, because there's a couple of different dimensions. Relative ancestor binding sounds like one thing.
Okay.
Like what I did with, you know, collapsing the combo box, the state name. So I have to think about that one more.
Okay. So implicit data templates are only on the type.
It's based on the type. Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
And it's, you know, it's got the heterogeneous collection, so you can, you had subtypes, but yeah, it's definitely based on the type.
All right. Thanks.
Hello.
Hi.
This is regarding printing. The two-part question, you would be able to print landscape and portrait, I take it, yes, right? And the second one is, if I'm printing landscape, and if the default printer is set to portrait, would it change automatically to landscape?
So the question is kind of related to just printing and interaction with the print dialog and users changing stuff in that. And the answer is no. At this point, we don't have any way to directly respond to that directly. But what's nice about with the other feature I didn't get a chance to talk about today, but Nick will talk about tomorrow, is with pinvoke, you can actually, in the print event that comes back, when you can start doing content, we haven't written this sample, but I imagine this can be done. A customer asked me about this yesterday. Is using pinvoke, I can go find out what the print dialog was set at, and then figure out what my print layout should be.
Pinvoke could be then out of browser, isn't it? Or can you do it in the browser?
Pinvoke will be in browser as well for full trust. So Nick will talk more around the full trust scenarios in browser. But yes, you'll be able
to
do that in browser.
But it's still full trust, though.
I'm sorry?
It is still full trust.
It's still full trust. Yeah, pinvoke is pretty much letting you loose to everything on that machine. I don't think anybody would be really happy if we let anybody go do that across any website.
So you have any plans in the future to resolve those issues?
We've gotten a lot of feedback around the print dialog in that. It's not something we're planning to do in this release. Again, we're always listening to feedback, and we'll try to incorporate that.
Okay, thank you.
But pinvoke is the great way to get to things that we didn't get a chance to get to.
I was just wondering if the custom dependency properties that attached dependency properties that cascade down the visual tree in Silverlight, is that going to be allowed at all, or in this, or in the future? Think about that.
Is that something? No, we're not supporting that. Sorry, not in this release. Still evaluating. You know, again, this is part of why we're taking time to finish up the release. So, you know, give us feedback. I've got the forums at Silverlight.net there, my blog, and definitely listen to more feedback.
Hi, I just wanted to ask, has there been bug fixes with memory leaks in Silverlight 5?
We don't have any memory leaks. What do you mean? It was all your code. Now we have data context change. It'll be all your code, and it'll be fixed. Yes.
I've got a blog post that can prove that.
I'm obviously joking. We've done a lot of memory leak fixing, you know, in this release. It's been a big focus of ours. As we went to out-of-browser apps, you know, apps were running much longer times. They would just leave them running for the week, so we couldn't just assume the page would be refreshed. So yeah, memory leaks has been a big focus of ours, and we hunt them down and fix them. And they're gnarly to fix, but we do.
So Silverlight 5 is improved over Silverlight 4, even the latest build of Silverlight 4?
Yeah.
Okay,
absolutely.
Thank you.
And if you're still seeing them in the beta, you know, send them our way. You know, we're always looking to nail those down.
This is a printing question. Can you tell us a little bit more about the vector printing? I don't know that any of our printers have PostScript drivers. I'm not sure how that's going to work in our buildings.
So what we will do is, we do use PostScript because, you know, that was the focus we want to do across all of the operating systems that we support. That was the one common place. Going forward, the reason we didn't call it PostScript on the output type is because we want to be able to enhance that. As vector printing engines are enhanced. So when it's set to vector, if your printer supports it, we will send vectors to it. But we have a fallback. So if we can't, we will just fall back to to bitmap printing.
Okay. The web browser control, any plan to make it in browser?
Yes, so we do now support, and Nick will show this tomorrow in his talk as well, so lots of tee up to his talks. On in-browser, it is a full trust scenario.
Okay.
Because, you know, we have all of the things that come through with browsers, and we want to make sure that we don't exploit anything. So in-browser, we'll have full trust.
About Mac?
Full trust in-browser, you can host another browser inside of Silverlight.
So it will work with Mac also? Mac?
No, I'm sorry.
It won't work with Mac. No. Oh, thanks.
That's it? All right. Well, I'll be around. I appreciate you guys coming, and we'd love hearing your feedback, and keep building Silverlight apps.